The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article from the Adventure column is My Reluctant Trip to the Titanic by Mike Reese. In 2023, the submersible Titan imploded in its way to view the famous sunken ocean liner. A year earlier, our author, a sitcom writer, took the same trip. Here is what he saw. I've spent 37 years working on The Simpsons as a writer, showrunner, and producer. I've written jokes for Johnny Carson, Joan Rivers, and, no joke, Pope Francis. I've met two Beatles and one president, Biden. Despite all that, I'm most famous as that guy who didn't die on that sub. That sub was the Titan, which imploded almost 3 years ago, killing all on board. 1 year before that happened, I rode the Titan 2.5 miles down to see the wreck of the Titanic. Let me begin by saying that my wife, Denise, and I like danger. And by my wife and I mean just my wife. Not me, not even a little. Our friends know this. So one called from Seattle to tell us, a guy in my neighborhood is building submarines to go to the bottom of the ocean. I replied, that sounds like a fun way to get killed. I would be right, but that was still years away. This was the first we'd heard of Stockton Rush. They say name is destiny. Martin Short really is short. Fats Domino was pretty fat. And Cedric the Entertainer looks like a Cedric. So when your name is Stockton Rush, you can't become a dog groomer. You are doomed to a life of adventure. Mr. Rush was as handsome and suave as a soap opera doctor. He had a smooth voice and a bottomless supply of quips like, you're never too old to be an idiot, and Clint Eastwood once told me, don't drop names. He'd have every career an 8-year-old boy could dream of, inventor, airline pilot, aerospace engineer testing F-15 fighter jets, and now a submersible captain. We were hooked. We took two trips with Captain Rush. The first, in 2020, left from an exotic port off a mysterious island known as Staten. 100 miles off Staten Island is Hudson Canyon, an underwater chasm the size of the Grand Canyon. We were going to dive it in the Cyclops, a submersible made by Stockton's private company, Ocean Gate. It was gleaming and streamlined, just like a Star Wars TIE fighter or a high-end vape pen. The viewport was a giant acrylic eyeball surrounded by spotlights and a laser. Since a submersible has to be towed to its dive spot, unlike a submarine, a tugboat pulled the Cyclops, bobbing and bouncing as we headed out to sea. And when we reached our dive spot, the Cyclops looked beat to hell, battered by waves and lashed by its own tow rope. The white outer shell had cracked. Chunks had fallen off, revealing the steel hull below. I heard that some lights and a laser were gone. Captain Rush surveyed the damage. We're good to go. The most dangerous part of riding the Cyclops was getting into the damn thing. Nobody put a lot of thought into this. They simply leaned a 6-foot kitchen ladder against the floating submersible. You had to scramble up the ladder as it bobbed with the waves, leap over to a tiny entry hatch on the top, then plunge blindly into the interior, dropping about 6 feet into darkness. Once you were in, it was groovy. Cool, dimly lit, quiet. The interior was about the same size as a minivan. It would seat 5 if there were seats. Instead, the 5 of us spread out on the carpeted floor. Pilot, co-pilot, my wife, myself, and one other rich, stupid tourist with a death wish. We sank noiselessly, peacefully through the ocean. The moment we touched bottom, a loud squawk came on the radio. Everything is broken. Everything, repeat, everything is broken. The sonar, the computers, and the lights had all stopped working. We went back to the surface immediately. While they repaired the submersible, we spent 3 days on the tugboat, trapped with the ship's cook, Psycho. This was more than a nickname. He had it embroidered on his overalls. I'm sure that's how he signed his taxes. Psycho! He explained, "Folks call me Psycho because I got yellow eyes like Anthony Perkins in that movie." Yeah, maybe. I once watched our Psycho chase a moth around the kitchen for an hour, muttering the whole time, "I'm going to get you, moth. You ain't going to get the better of me. No moth going to get outsmart Psycho." Two notes. The moth did outsmart Psycho, and Anthony Perkins did not have yellow eyes. When the submersible was fixed, we took another dive into Hudson Canyon. 1,000 feet down, the ocean floor looked like a landscape from a Roadrunner cartoon. Miles of sand, bizarre rocks, and the occasional coral branching out like a saguaro cactus. It was amazing. 3 hours raced by like 3 minutes. When Captain Rush was preparing to surface, we begged him for another 3 hours. In June 2022, Denise and I stood on a dock in St. John's, Newfoundland. Out in the harbor was the ship that would carry us and another submersible called the Titan to the very spot where the Titanic sank. A rubber speedboat pulled up to take us to the ship. The skipper stopped short and said, "Oh, man, I forgot the life jackets." I muttered, "That's the same thing they said on the Titanic." This was my wife's birthday week, and this trip was her present. It shows you how a man would rather risk his life on a dangerous mission than go to Macy's and buy a scarf she hates. Captain Rush built this submersible specifically for the Titanic dive. It was white and bulbous, like a Star Wars Imperial Stormtrooper's helmet. The Titan looked super cool from the front, but in the back it had a bunch of plastic foam blocks strapped on the outside to improve buoyancy. They said this was super high-tech plastic foam, but it looked like the crap every 80s stereo came packed in. The Titan had one tiny porthole, the size and shape of a window on a washing machine. That's where it may have come from. There were also two flotation tanks that looked like bulging eyes, and a landing pad that resembled a gaping mouth. The submersible looked scared to death. So was I. The Titan had many setbacks before getting to this point. There was the pandemic. Then it got struck by lightning, frying the electronics. On a test dive, a system failure trapped everyone inside for 27 hours. And finally, the toilet broke. This seemed nearly impossible, since the toilet was basically a potty seat. Two pieces, no moving parts. Captain Rush was detailing all these setbacks to us with a PowerPoint presentation when the computer froze and died. Uh-oh. Then he brought out the waivers for us to sign. Here are some highlights. When diving below the ocean's surface, this vessel will be subject to extreme pressure, and any failure of the vessel while I am aboard could cause me severe injury, disability, emotional trauma, other harm, and or death. I will be exposed to risks associated with high-pressure gases, pure oxygen surfacing, high-voltage electrical systems, and other dangers that could lead to property damage, injury, disability, emotional harm, or death. If I am injured during the expedition, I may not receive immediate medical attention. Welcome aboard. Our ship sailed for 2 days, 300 miles into the North Atlantic. This was a working-class blue-collar vessel. Its usual job was laying transatlantic cables. And they served the manly man food I loved: meatloaf, burritos, pizza. The cooks were Newfoundlanders, a people so insular they still had the Irish accent of their distant ancestors. The day finally arrived. We were anchored about 2 miles above the wreck of the Titanic. They outfitted Denise and me in matching navy blue flight suits. It was supposed to make me seem like a crew member, but I just felt like an idiot. It's like when you put a fire chief's helmet on a five-year-old. He may look cute, but he ain't putting out any fires. We were now ready to board the submersible. We just had to take a COVID-19 test. I passed mine. Denise failed hers. Captain Rush said, "Sorry, Denise, you can't take the trip." "But Mike, you can still go." I said, "I don't want to go." It's as if Neil Armstrong were getting ready to go to the moon when he came down with the flu. So NASA tells his wife, "You can go to the moon instead." At Denise's urging, I got on board and began the two-hour descent straight to the bottom of the sea. The number of mishaps preceding this trip was amazing when you see how simple a submersible is. It's basically a car that you drunkenly drove into the ocean. It sinks like a stone until it hits bottom. When you want to come up, you drop some of your weights and pop to the surface like a cork. That's it. Sink like a stone, pop up like a cork. When they wanted to tilt our vessel down, the pilot yelled, "Everyone pile into the front. Hurry, hurry." To tilt it up, "Get in the back. Move it, move it." To steer it, the pilot used an Xbox game controller. I don't mean that it looked like one or was similar to one. It was an actual joystick from a gaming system. How can I describe my voyage to the bottom of the sea? It was boring. The ocean is pretty empty here, so there was nothing to see out the porthole. I actually fell asleep. And if you want a shock, try waking up from a nap, thinking you're at home in bed, and realizing you're trapped in a steel tube 2 miles underwater and sinking. We touched bottom amid the usual assortment of catastrophes. We were nowhere near the Titanic. There were underwater currents pushing us farther and farther in the wrong direction. The sonar wasn't working, and the compass kept flopping from east to west, north to south. A compass has one job, and it wasn't doing it. There was also a time crunch. We had started late, and there was a hurricane rolling in on the surface. Just another day in the life of Captain Stockton Rush. A navigator on the surface sent us directions, but they didn't conform to what we were seeing. Our Russian science officer kept radioing the surface. "We need better directions. Switch to B-map." The reply? "What is the B-map?" There were five of us in the submersible, and four of us were working on the navigation. I was just 180 pounds of ballast. And finally, just before we had to resurface, we saw it. The bow of the Titanic. We had minutes to snap selfies with the famous parts. The railing, the prow, the anchor. It looked just like it did in the movies. It wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't underwhelming. It was just whelming. The only real danger came in the last minute of the trip. As the Titan was being hoisted back onto the ship, the whole thing flipped vertical. Everything inside, computers, phones, five people and their sandwiches, crashed in a heap at the bottom. Our trip to the Titanic ended in chaos. Still, for me, the submersible was a technological marvel. It was so perfectly pressurized that I went from sea level to 2.5 miles deep and back again, and my ears never popped. It was only when the voyage ended that I learned the import of what I'd been through. Captain Rush told me, "More people have been in outer space than have done what you did yesterday." A passenger for Guadalajara became the first Mexican ever to reach the Titanic. I became the first Simpsons writer to get there. Denise was already planning a return trip so we could visit the Titanic together. That trip I never wanted to take, I'd be taking it twice. Whatever it cost me, I'd be paying double. But it was not to be. A year later, the Titan imploded, killing all on board. After 4 days of searching for the Titan, they found its wreckage. The submersible had failed 1 hour and 33 minutes into the dive. This sparked a 4-day worldwide media frenzy. The public wanted someone to blame, and Stockton Rush became their villain. They fed off news stories that depicted recklessness, cost-cutting, and deceit. And then there was a documentary that included a clip of a former OceanGate employee calling Stockton a borderline psychopath. That didn't sound anything like my experience. Stockton Rush was the most meticulous, detail-oriented man I ever met. He insisted I attend his morning briefings and evening recaps, and man, they were boring. He would carefully run through endless checklists. In fact, he gave me a copy of his favorite book, The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. If I live to be 10,000, I will never read this book. As far as I could tell, everyone, the public, the media, was too focused on the waiver we had signed that listed 100 ways to die. But they missed the point. Rush had thought of everything. He made sure we knew the risks. We went anyhow. The National Transportation Safety Board blamed the accident on inadequate engineering process. But was it recklessness or the risks that come with pioneering? Apollo 1 caught fire on the launch pad, killing all on board. Still, we made it to the moon 2 years later. Stockton Rush was what we used to admire, a visionary, a dreamer who made his dreams come true. He had many successful dives and brought dozens of people like me down to see the Titanic. He did the impossible, not once, but over and over. Then his luck ran out, as luck does. That was My Reluctant Trip to the Titanic by Mike Reese. And now a second article from the Everyday Heroes column. Pumped Up. A man who had never been in a fight in his life finds himself in a fight for his life by Derek Burnett. At a little after 11 a.m. on New Year's Day of 2024, Lynn William Segebart stopped by a gas station in Palm Springs, Florida, near his home in Lantana. Tomorrow would be the start of a new work week at his job managing inventory for a beverage distributor, and he stopped to buy bottled water to get him through the next couple of days. As he stood in the checkout line behind a few other customers, he heard screaming coming from outside. The others in the store either didn't hear or chose to ignore the commotion. Segebart, 61, put down the water and rushed out the door. What he saw shocked him. Over by the gas pumps, a man was being stabbed. Moments before, 21-year-old Enrique Velasquez had been pumping gas into his blue Chevy Camaro when a man he'd never seen before stepped from the other side of the pumps and said, "I'm going to kill you today." Before Velasquez could react, his attacker, 43-year-old Jose Juan Miranda, drew a serrated 6-inch drywall knife and began thrusting it into Velasquez's face and body. Backpedaling, Velasquez tripped over the gas hose and tumbled to the ground, with Miranda still on the attack. As Segebart showed up, Miranda was kneeling over his victim and had already slashed and stabbed him several times. Segebart ran up behind Miranda and seized his right wrist with both hands. Miranda was decidedly larger than Segebart, who stands at 5'5" with a slight build and almost 20 years younger. Still, Segebart managed to pull hard enough that Miranda straightened his arm. Stuck in this position, Segebart then threw his full weight onto Miranda's back, and the two of them fell forward onto the screaming Velasquez, the knife still gripped tightly in Miranda's hand. Segebart pulled and twisted at the hand holding the blade, but Miranda held on as the two men grunted and struggled. "If I can't get it away from him," Segebart thought, "maybe I can make it unusable." With all his strength, he grabbed the knife near its hilt and pushed it down on the pavement. The blade's serrated edge cut into Segebart's left pinky finger, but he kept pressing as hard as he could. Finally, the blade bent, making it no longer effective for stabbing, but still plenty dangerous. Seized by a sudden new fury, Miranda rolled his head and sank his teeth into Segebart's right forearm. The pain was blinding. Segebart had to act. with both his hands still occupied in the struggle for control of the knife. He had only one other weapon at his disposal, his head. He reared back and slammed his forehead into the base of Miranda's skull, once, twice, three times. Miranda's grip softened, allowing Segobart to pull the knife out of his fingers and toss it clattering across the pavement. Meanwhile, another bystander, Mario Fialos, who had been putting air in his truck tires, ran over. He helped pull Miranda off Velasquez and hold him until the police arrived. Velasquez was rushed to a nearby trauma center, where he was treated for multiple stab wounds on his face, arms, legs, and upper chest, and a bite on his left shoulder. Miranda was charged with attempted first-degree murder with a deadly weapon. His case, which is still pending, has been transferred to the Mental Health Division of the Palm Beach County Circuit Court System. There is still no known motive for the attack. As for Lynn William Segobart, he is a mild-mannered and soft-spoken man who had never before been in a fight. So why did he rush into someone else's emergency, knowing he could have been killed? After some thought, Segobart says somberly, "I lost my son a year before. He took his own life. I didn't care what happened to me. I didn't want somebody else to go through what I went through with losing their child." That was Pumped Up by Derek Burnett. And now, something on the lighter side. Glad to hear it. Three stories to make your day. Strangers No More. Aaron Jackson flew from Arkansas to New York City in February 2024. While out to eat in Brooklyn, she struck up a conversation with a woman seated at the next table, a local named Sue. The two hit it off, so much so that they agreed to reunite same place, same time, 10 months later. They chose not to trade numbers. They would just have to trust each other to show up. Aaron held up her end, flying back to the Big Apple in December. While walking toward the restaurant, she was thrilled to spot Sue. "I can't believe this," Sue shouts in a video Aaron posted to Instagram. Despite it being just their second meeting, Aaron chimed in, "We're best friends." The pair will surely be seeing more of each other as Aaron has since moved to Brooklyn. From having a cow to helping. While Morgan Bann was driving in Eminence, Indiana last April, her 9-year-old son, Wyatt, asked her to turn around. He had spotted a cow in a field they had driven past. It seemed frantic, and Wyatt wondered why. At first, Morgan kept on driving, but Wyatt, a budding rodeo star who's used to being around cattle, begged and begged. So Morgan gave in and headed back so he could investigate. Wyatt slipped through the fence and into the pasture. As he neared the cow, he saw the source of her distress. Her calf had fallen into a creek bed with steep banks, too steep for it to climb out or for her to climb in. Wyatt jumped into the ditch, got behind the frightened calf, and gently pushed it up and out. Then he walked back to his mom, as the calf did the same. A bright spot for patients. Boston Medical Center has 514 beds and 519 solar panels. Sure, some of that power helps run the hospital, but half of it goes to patients in the form of a monthly credit of about $50 on their home utility bills. Officials call it the Clean Power Prescription Program, and the goal is to ease the financial burden on some 80 patients who need to run breathing assistance machines, charge electric wheelchairs, or power other medical devices. Bob Biggio, the hospital's chief sustainability officer, told KFF Health News, "This just seemed like the right thing to do." And next from the Best Pet Helpers column, "Where Dogs Can't Sniff, This Otter Dives In," by Caroline Fanning. Since last January, a new search and recovery team member has been in hot pursuit of missing persons in Southwest Florida's lakes, rivers, and bays. Splash, a 2-year-old otter, jumps in where dogs leave off, as canine noses lose the trail at the water's edge. But an otter's unique underwater senses allow Splash to taste the bubbles in the water for a human scent. When he makes a discovery, he squeaks an alert to his handler, Michael Hadsell. An Asian small clawed otter, Splash is the first of his species to be used for search and recovery. Hadsell, who has worked with Peace Canine Search and Rescue's canine teams for years, wondered, why can't an otter do this? He has trained Splash since the eager otter was 4 months old, fresh from the Wildlife World Zoo near Phoenix, Arizona. When Splash isn't working, he's home with Hadsell and the dogs, diving in the pool and snoozing on the couch. After some missions, he gets a bath and a few days of rest to make sure he stays healthy. We call those his union breaks, says Hadsell. And lastly, a couple of very short pieces from life in these United States. It took years, but I finally finished my family's genealogical tree and sent off binders containing the information to my extended family. But when I visited my mother, I was embarrassed to discover I'd sent her an incomplete set. I'm sorry your set is missing some cousins, I said. I'll send you a complete binder once I get home. You already did, she said. I just took out all the people I don't like. By Deborah McCabe from Houston, Texas. Stop leaving your children with their grandparents to babysit. I asked my nephew how old he was going to be, and he said, if the Lord sees fit, 10 in November. As a mom of two needy toddlers, I struggle to find a moment of privacy during the day. Recently, I found refuge in the bathroom. I was sitting quietly, enjoying a moment alone, when the door burst open. It was my 3-year-old. Oh, I'm sorry, Mommy. Do you want to be alone? Yes, honey, that would be very nice, I said. With that, he walked into the bathroom and shut the door. There, he said. Now no one can bother us. Christine Paquette, Pengrove, California. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.